the OTB Podcast Network. Football is back.
Follow Sterling! Raheem Sterling!
Keep up to date with the latest scores on the OTB Sports app, live updates and analysis of Premier League action. The OTB Sports app, live score updates straight to your phone.
Football on Off the Ball
with Paddy Power, fueling the mischief in the beautiful game.
Gamble responsibly. CWE.net.
And you're welcome back to Off the Ball Saturday here on News Talk. John Duggan with you through till 5 o'clock in the company of the former Republic of Ireland international defender Gary Breen, the football correspondent of the Irish Independent Dan McDonnell, and the broadcaster and journalist Johnny Ward. Remember, our football coverage brought to you thanks to Paddy Power. For more information on responsible gambling, visit dunluie.net. You can text us 53106. You can tweet us at Off the Ball. We're streaming live as well now, so you can watch us on the Off the Ball social channels for Periscope and Twitter at Off the Ball, on YouTube, on Facebook, and on the new OTB Sports app for iOS and Android. Search OTB Sports in your app store now. So join the conversation about the Premier League. The new season back underway today. We want you to get involved with your predictions for the new campaign. Who will win the title? Who will be champions? What's your top four? What are the three clubs that are going to go down? Who's your Golden Boot winner? Who's your player of the year? Who's going to be sacked first? 53106 for your messages. So we already have one result in. Arsenal hitting the ground running, beating Fulham 3-0 at Craven Cottage. Goals by Alexander Lacazette, new signing Gabriel, the defender, the Brazilian, and a goal machine that is Pierre-Emerick Aubameyang. Another signing, Willian, had a hand in all three goals. Gary, good afternoon. I get the sense that Mikel Arteta knows exactly what he's doing. A very impressive start.
Good afternoon. Yeah, it is an impressive start, and it's in keeping with how they finished the season, really, in terms of those big wins against Chelsea, Man City, to win the FA Cup. Obviously, then Liverpool in the Community Shield as well. So we know it's a work in progress at Arsenal, but certainly Arteta has been so impressive, really, in terms of what he inherited when he first went in there. And in more than anything, not the situation that happened under the previous manager, but the quality of player. And he's actually managing to get more performances out of those players, but slowly but surely just get his own type of players in who commit to the type of work effort, responsibility you have to play for his team. So it bodes well for Arsenal.
Lads, good afternoon. I'd say, as a Spurs fan, I'd rather be in Arsenal's position right now. Arteta seems to know what he's at. They've started really well. Now, Fulham were pretty poor this afternoon, but if you're a Gunners fan, it's only going up, I think, at the moment.
Yeah, I mean, there's always a danger with first games of the season, yeah. You know, and there's always a danger of overreacting to it. I always make the point, closer to home a couple of years back, I think it was the first game of the season where Dundalk drew nil-all with Bray Wanderers, and Dundalk went on to score a record number of goals that season. I think Bray conceded a record number of goals. So, like, it's almost like the first game of the season can be unbelievably deceptive because there's a degree of anticipation around it. So it's like analysed to death because it's like, well, here we go. What does this mean? But at the same time, you could probably look at both of those teams today and go down the route of wondering, is this a sign of what's to come? Maybe for Fulham, it's a sense of you know, they need to do more work before the window closes. And I think in everything we discussed today about, the season ahead, I think there is an asterisk in terms of any predictions because I think there's still so much transfer business left to come. But definitely Arsenal, I have to admit, I'll bow to Gary's sort of knowledge of Arsenal generally. I didn't see a huge amount of them just post-lockdown for whatever reason, the games they played. The results are encouraging. It appears that they have signed astutely enough, you know, in terms of Gabriel, the reports seem to be positive. And they also have, you know, they start the season with the top scorer from last season, even though they didn't necessarily have a great season themselves. So, like, they, you know, as in, you know, within the squad that's there, even coming off the back of a year that was a bit maybe underwhelming, you know, in a bottom line league finish way, they have all the ingredients to have a decent season. I think they'll finish in the top four, personally. Now, that means someone else has to miss out who's reasonably high profile. And they're not, you know, if you look at the books, you know, they're sort of fifth favourite in that respect. But I just have this feeling they're going to have a good year.
Who's going to miss out, Dan?
Well, I actually, we had to do something similar for the newspaper. I'm not sure if it's fully appeared or the full predictions yet, but I have to admit, I went for Manchester United to miss out in the top four. Oh. And I completely understand. I mean, I think it's pretty tight. Like, they could just as easily finish second, you know? Like, I think there's there's possibilities and a variety of permutations and combinations that you could conceivably predict. And I don't think anyone could say you're talking rubbish. But I just have this feeling that maybe some of the revival was a bit overstated last year. There's no doubt that there's like some really encouraging signs, but you see like Mason Greenwood, hugely promising player, but then he's been involved in this thing with England. It shows how like when you have these promising young players, little things can happen that can derail them very easily. There's no doubt like Bruno Fernandes, exceptional signing. I understand all the arguments for it, but I just wonder, do some of the teams around them have a little bit more and possibly might be a bit more, I don't know. I guess there's a, you know, to predict that Chelsea are in that top four, I guess you're putting on trust that their signings work out, but they have like signed extensively enough. I know Manchester United have brought in Van der Beek as well. I just have a slight niggling feeling that there may still be a soft centre there to some degree and problems that can stem up quickly enough. You even saw in the run in, you know, they concede the late goal to Southampton in one game. The Europa League didn't work out. I'm just not fully convinced, I have to say. And I think maybe, I went for Arsenal and Chelsea to finish ahead of them, but I completely understand. I think Johnny's probably going to disagree with me, and I can understand the conflicting view, but someone's going to have to miss out.
And Johnny, do you disagree?
I'd agree in the sense that it's very, very hard to call. I think we predicted in the League of Ireland this season that it would definitely be Dundalk and Shamrock Rovers dominating, and kind of hasn't worked out like that. And look for a while that Bowes might have a chance. The Premier League, it's probably similar enough for not quite as kind of probable that it will be one of the top two teams. Even though, like, I'm not really sold by Manchester City entirely. I think they showed weaknesses at the end of last season that they shouldn't. And I think their Champions League failure at this stage is very, very disappointing. Man United were very strong post-lockdown, but they did show frailties. Chelsea have obviously spent. And Arsenal, I do think Arteta's going to be a good manager. I think the signing of Willian was a very good signing. I think they've just a decent kind of solidity in that team. I think Man United will finish in the first four, but I'd be with Dan. I think Arsenal have a very reasonable chance. It might be Chelsea that miss out for me, but maybe the title race will be slightly more interesting, despite the fact that Liverpool have just spent so little. It's really remarkable, and I like to see that. I like to see continuity, but at the same time, you would have hoped that they would have gotten Thiago or whatever, but it's going to be a very interesting season. I was just looking at the betting for relegation there. It's so lacking clarity there as well. Maybe Fulham would be favourites after today, but the backdrop of all this is there are no crowds at games, and that probably, I would argue, it makes it easier for the better teams. You put two teams on a pitch. Pitches are excellent. They're not playing at 10,000 metres above sea level with no crowd to influence the game. Basically, the best team should win, and I think the unpredictability of matches is slightly taken away when there's no crowd.
About Gabriel, he had more touches of the ball, attempted more passes and completed more passes than anybody else on his debut in English football, 22 years of age. The Crystal Palace playing Southampton, Will Smallbone in the Southampton team, James McCarthy in the Palace team, Shane Long and Michael Obafemi on the bench for the Saints. That we'll keep up to date on that, and also all the goals in the Championship as well. We've had a couple of results in there from as well. So Birmingham City won, Brentford 0, Brentford who so narrowly missed out on promotion and defeated today. Wycombe Wanderers 0, Rotherham 1. Can you expect Gary Arsenal to be a bit more reliable than we would have expected them to be in the last few seasons under Arteta?
Yeah, I think they will be because of Arteta in terms of what he demands from and the quality of work on the training ground. There's no doubt about that. He puts an emphasis on how good they are on the ball. Of course, that's the Arsenal way, and we were seeing that all the time under Wenger. But the big difference is how good they are without the ball, and that's where they were often so frail that you could get at them and situations like that. In terms of Arsenal making a top four, I'm not convinced, because I think it's going to take another couple of windows for Arteta to really weed out those players who have been serial failures for Arsenal. I know we talk about the FA Cup as such, and those same players that I mentioned, he has got a tune out of them, there's no doubt about that. But I always feel that they're going to let you down at the vital time. Just when Arsenal are predicted to do something special, they implode. And so that would always be the concern. Certainly going forward, Aubameyang is massive, but I think people realise it. The amount of goals he's got was incredible, because Arsenal in the bottom, half of the table in terms of chances created. So that suggests that needs to improve. So there's a massive over-reliance on him. The suggestion is that he will sign his contract, which is a massive boost for them. But other players need to step up. They really do.
Who?
I think the likes of Pepe for the money that he's had, whoever he's playing. I think Willian's a brilliant signing. Even at times at Chelsea, I know he's won so much there, but even the Chelsea fans used to get on the back of him. But I think he'd be a brilliant addition to Arsenal, I really do. But I think it's a collective. I think there's too often that they've relied on Aubameyang. And if at times he does go missing in the games, they need to be a threat from elsewhere. They really do. So I am certainly excited about what Arteta's doing. There's no doubt about that. I think he's been a brilliant addition, bearing in mind it's his first job as a manager. This will be his first full season. But I still think there's a lot of work to be done, and I would be amazed on if they do make that top four.
Oh,
I think Aubameyang's going to win that Golden Boot. Like, that's 22 goals last season. He's a machine.
Well, he is, but the likes of Vardy is a machine even at his age as well. And you're probably looking at Harry Kane, Aguero, in terms of the injuries that they had last season. If they can stay fit and healthy, they'll be up there challenging. There's no doubt about that. But certainly, he's finally, and this is a strange thing to say, bearing in mind how good he was at Dortmund, but I think he's finally now getting the type of accolades he deserves, because everyone never felt he was quite top-class centre-forward. We certainly proved that over the last couple of seasons at Arsenal.
Liverpool, Gary, just so we go through the top clubs here, have they done enough in the transfer window for you to be back-to-back winners of the Premier League title? Did they need to?
Well, listen, it's so difficult to win back-to-back titles. We know that only City have done it over the last 10, 11 years or so. But if you think about growing up and you think of the great dominance Liverpool had before, we always used to hear that their players would say that one player or two players would come in the summer after winning the title, just to strengthen it, just to keep people on their toes. We heard the same similar things under Ferguson's dominance at Manchester United. So you are looking at that situation and thinking, well, why haven't they strengthened? But the reality is, who could you actually get to strengthen that team? The only standout one, and we're hearing so much about this, is Thiago at Bayern Munich, in terms of what he gives you in terms of that ability on the ball. That's something that is very different to those midfield players that they have at Liverpool. Hard working, industrious, yeah, but not really the ones who can like thread the pass through the eye of a needle as such. But then if you do get that player, does it detract on what those midfielders give you? Because essentially the attacking emphasis is from those front three and obviously those fullbacks getting into high and advanced positions. So I do look at that situation and think, well, listen, it's difficult to strengthen that Liverpool team. My only concern would be is that if you think about Van Dijk, he's been an ever-present now for two consecutive seasons. If he suddenly was to get an injury, it would be a massive impact. I don't think you can get a centre-half that can replace him, but I think they may need to strengthen in that area because Gomez, Matip have had their injuries. So that would be a little bit of a concern. But Jurgen Klopp has been there before. He's won back-to-back titles with that Dortmund team, taking on the giants of Bayern Munich. So he knows what is needed. And he has been quite vocal this week, saying, listen, we can't go out and buy players, we just have to find and wait for the right player. And I totally agree and certainly totally trust his judgment.
I think as well, JD, on Liverpool, it shouldn't be, you know, forgotten that they have some really, really promising young players coming through.
Yeah.
And I think that'll be, it'd be interesting to know this, Gary, because in terms of your experience, I think Klopp is very wary of bringing in any players that would accept that would do anything to kind of challenge the character in that squad, you know. So I think his character vetting would be a big part of his signings.
I think so. I think you're absolutely right, Johnny, in terms of that, because they've got something unique there in terms of the camaraderie. They've got the team spirit. That it all seems to be, it's not even about individuals. Even if you think about Salah, I know that he's the guy who normally goes through one-on-one, doesn't look to square it to Mane or anything, but even they've got him putting in a real shift and stuff like that. So they all contribute. And that's part of doing your recruitment. It really is. You can identify players with the ability, but do they have the personality? Do they have the mindset to really buy into what you're trying to achieve as a team, as a squad? So that's just as important above all else, other than just the quality, which will have to be of the highest level to improve this Liverpool team.
The Anfield factor, 55 points in 57 last season. Is that a negative that they don't have any crowds there?
Well, listen, who's taking that question? Sorry.
No, Gary, go for it. No, go it. No, I actually, you can probably give us a better input on what the impact it might actually have. You know, it's actually, you do wonder across the full season, does you know, is it going to weaken them in any way? You would think, I know Johnny's point about, you know, closed doors football, like, it should favour the bigger teams. But I guess, you know, if you're a bigger team that has hometown advantage that is actually quite substantial, you would, you know, you would think it might take things away to some degree. I don't know what you think, Gary.
Well, if you think about, Dan, in terms of going to certain grounds and the challenge that Leeds United have in terms of staying in the Premier League, I think any opposition players will be saying, well, listen, it's a tough game because it's Elland Road, the crowd. And I totally agree with you. There are certain teams that the supporters will be a huge miss. Of course they will. You know, I think we probably are missing that with the national team as well. But There's no doubt Liverpool, in terms of getting to Anfield, at times it feels like the Kop is sucking the ball in and certainly draining energy out of the opposition team. So I think it does play a role. There's no doubt about it. But I think Liverpool are that strong, are that good a team that I think they will brush most teams aside at Anfield anyway.
I think the one thing about Liverpool is it's a potential issue. Like, they have, I think, you know, they have an excellent squad and they have good young players coming through. But certainly, like, that is a significant point about if they were to lose like a Van Dijk or someone. And also the fact that it's not just that the crowds aspect of this season. I mean, they're cramming the season a small bit. It's going to be a relentless enough season. So, like, you know, they don't necessarily have like the biggest squad of the unbelievable squad depth, say, that there is a couple of areas where if they get an odd injury or two, that could be a problem for them. Now, again, they might bring in one or two before the window closes, so we could be having a different discussion in a month's time. But I think like the relentless nature of this season is something that has to be mentioned as well. I think momentum is going to be a big thing. It's almost like a championship season where the championship is so much about momentum with all these Saturday games, that if a team starts well, it can just carry them along. And I think that's the one thing that, you know, this is where you would think with Liverpool, that mentality would be good, that they're not going to go through that, like Man City a couple of seasons ago, where like they almost won every second season because they'd coast a bit off the back of winning one. Like, it is a new challenge for Liverpool. We just assume all we read and see and hear about the mentality that Klopp has instilled in the place, they should avoid that, but they sort of have to start well. Like, I just think that momentum is going to be big. If you look at the fixture list, it's just pretty full on, and there's no real time to breathe and take stock if things aren't working.
Well, they said about the winter break, Klopp has been a massive, both he and Guardiola have kept on about it all the time, about this winter break, they won't have that opportunity now this season. You're right. That's such a valid point in terms of how condensed this season will be. It'll be a test. It really will, in terms of, but certainly when you think about teams who play with such high energy that you're not going to get those recovery times. And even if it's just 1 or 2 days, even with these sports scientists, it makes such a massive difference. Even looking at this game in terms of Liverpool v Leeds today, if you think about Bielsa in terms of how hard he works his players, they have known throughout the history of his coaching career that his teams really fade badly towards the end of the season because they just don't have the energy levels to be able to keep it up. And the very fact that lockdown came at the time it did for Leeds gave those players an opportunity to really have a boost, regroup, and their form then after that was what drove them to the championship title. So I think that'll be something that will be applicable to so many of the teams, the top teams, how you play, the smaller squads like Burnley, who have such a small turnaround in terms of how many people start games, how few subs they use. I think it's going to be a real challenge for all the managers in the Premier League this season.
How much confidence do you get from that momentum, Gary, when you're on that run? Like Liverpool, 99, 97 points the last two seasons. That run to the Champions League, they lost to Real Madrid, then they beat Spurs. They've been at it quite a long time. Is there any kind of a worry about fatigue or hunger here?
I don't. It's not something I'd ever accuse Klopp's teams of doing it. But if you remember his last season at Dortmund, they started dreadfully, didn't they? They were down the bottom until the end. So I don't know whether or not the fact that they're now the team that are being hunted will change the dynamics slightly. Because if you think about, they lose that Champions League final to Real Madrid, and then that's the motivation to come back stronger. They win it the next season. They miss out on the title by 1 point to Manchester City, and then they come back again and romp home. So that's the challenges. But I've got no doubt in terms of looking at the makeup and the characters of those players, and certainly their manager, I think they'll be up for the challenge. I really do.
We got a goal in the game at Selhurst Park. Crystal Palace against Southampton. Mike Lawrence.
Crystal Palace 1, Southampton 0. Wilfried Zaha has given the home side the lead against the run of play after a bright start from the visitors. Andros Townsend with a great run down the right. His cross was volleyed home with the right foot first time from Wilfried Zaha. His manager this week said he's been unsettled by transfer speculation. Nothing unsettled about that finish. Crystal Palace 1, Southampton 0.
You're talking about squad strength there. I think that's a very important point, Dan. Like Curtis Jones, Nico Williams, Harvey Elliott, can these lads make an impact at Liverpool?
Well, I mean, you know, you saw Williams what scored for Wales last week, and you know, those cup ties last year, you know, the young players came in and they all did very well and they all look very talented players. And I guess, you know, the best teams integrate these players slowly rather than necessarily place huge responsibility on them immediately. I mean, the answer is I don't know, really. Like, I don't think anyone knows until they're actually... You know, there was a novelty aspect. Like there was that game against Everton last year in the cup and the pressure was off them. Whereas obviously it's different if you're in a bit of a, say, a negative run and then there's a big game and they're thrust in there and then it doesn't work out and there's question marks and scrutiny, of course. Like, you trust in the judgment of the management, again, that, like, you know, that they'll be used at the right times and the appropriate times. I mean, you look at someone like Joe Gomez now, who's grown in stature and is definitely, you know, probably the first choice now, really. And with him, it's been a steady, you know, integration process. And he had, you know, Lovren and Matip and various players that were ahead of him at various stages. And he's come to the fore. I don't think any of those that you named there that they probably want to be in a situation where they're viewed as first choice players this season, you know, as in, you know, I think it's about the longer run. But I mean, you just don't know. I don't think anyone could say with certainty, you know, that someone's absolutely 100% going to make an impact. But I think the point is, with the nature of the season and the way it's going to be, and you're going to obviously throw the Champions League into it, we're probably going to find out a lot about them because they're going to have to play for that burnout reason that Gary alludes to there. And yeah, like the point that the teams who operate at a particular intensity and, you know, they're very conscious of managing their workloads and whatever it might be. You're going to see a lot of those lads. So I suspect we'll be very well informed about them, you know, by this time next year, for sure.
It's very refreshing, JD, as well, when you look back at, you know, when Manchester United famously won the league with kids. I think the idea that you can... You know, as they did, kind of get rid of some senior players and rely on this talent and make it work almost straight away is really, really kind of something that would definitely appeal to me in terms of having the likes of Trent Alexander-Arnold, who grew up in the city, as you know, and becoming the best player in the world, probably in his position, playing for his local team. And with Brexit coming in, you know, British clubs will not be able to sign minors from the EU once this would seem to be the case. Anyway, once Brexit comes into play, so that will put more reliance on homegrown talent from England, effectively, or from the UK. And it's just refreshing to see all these kids coming through. Far be it for me to say that, you know, it's going to work, but I would prefer Klopp kind of sticking with what he has. Gradually kind of inculcating a bit of confidence and maybe, you know, self-belief in these young players rather than just throwing like 200 or 300 million
like
at
Chelsea have.
Cards. Yeah, like, so, like, obviously, the Chelsea one is interesting because last season was obviously such an outlier, but, you know, it's nice that Lampard was able to do that. And I think that matters. I think as a football fan, I want to see my home team play with players that are from my area. I certainly want to see young players coming through rather than, you know, just throwing money at the situation. And I think, you know, you have to be able to identify with the club. And Liverpool fans, young and old, will be really energised by the fact that they have some seriously promising young players. And they probably will get a chance. As Dan says, it is a compact season. Liverpool play quite relentless. The one counterpoint I would have against that is, you know, you look at Liverpool's games, three quarters of them are fairly routine. So I think they will be able to kind of, you know, shuffle the pack a bit. And I, for one, expect Salah to have a better season this season than his last two, because I think he has had something of a break now. And I think if he can get back to the form he was in three seasons ago, he'd be my idea of the top scorer. But I think he's going to have a better season.
Robin Monaghan says that Liverpool need to strengthen the bench. Just to let you know that Champers Elise has won the Matron Stakes, the Group 1, at Leopardstown on Champions Stakes weekend.
Well, this is a great story, JD. It
was Johnny Murta.
Yeah, I think I spoke to him 2 weeks ago, and he was telling me that there was a race meeting in Tipperary that was called off that day or the day after, and he was gutted because he said this filly is in unbelievable form. And he bought her for like 28 grand or something like that. She's not fashionably bred. They came up with the name over the course of a night out. Johnny, of course, doesn't drink, but he was with a few owners. And as the beer and the champagne kept flowing, they said, "So why don't we come up with Champers Elysee?" Because you think the horse is by Champs-Élysées. It actually isn't. It's just because they were drinking a lot of champagne that night. And to win the Matron Stakes with a horse that cost, you know, the equivalent of, what would you get for 27 grand? Not very much nowadays. And to win the Matron Stakes. And Johnny Murtagh, the season he's had, it's been absolutely phenomenal. And he's put a lot of faith in young talent as well, but with his jockeys. And it's just a great story.
Colin Keane aboard the 9-2 shot. And Monday won the first of the 2 o'clock at 12-1. Halimi won the second race there. The Champion Stakes is underway at 4:10. We'll keep you up to date what's going on in Leopardstown. And of course, the Curragh tomorrow on tomorrow's show. We got to take a break. 5-3-1-0-6 for predictions, folks, about the new season in the Premier League. Your top four, the bottom three. I was asking people this on Twitter during the week and yesterday. So we'd Rob Byrne saying Liverpool to win the title, Man City, United and Wolves. They're the top four. To go down, Sheffield United, West Ham and West Brom. Golden Boot, Mo Salah. Manager to go first, Roy Hodgson. Surprise that Chelsea was sacked Lampard by Christmas. Vincent Murphy went for Liverpool to win the title. Chelsea, City and Arsenal in that order. The Golden Boot, Salah. The surprise, West Ham top seven. And Keith Halligan's surprise were Leeds to do well. Liverpool to win the title from Man City, Man United and Spurs. And just to finish here, Gareth Toohey said that Man City win the title ahead of Liverpool, Chelsea and United. The biggest surprise, Leeds top seven. Leeds playing at 5:30 against Liverpool. We'll have the teams obviously from that shortly. It's Crystal Palace 1, Southampton 0. Earlier on, Arsenal beat Fulham by 3-0. Andros Townsend scoring for Palace at Selhurst Park. Just to go through the scores in the Championship. Full times, Birmingham 1, Brentford 0, Wickham 0, Rotherham 1, and latest scores, Bournemouth 1, Blackburn Rovers 0, goalless between Barnsley and Luton. It's Bristol City 1, Coventry City 0, Cardiff City 0, Sheffield Wednesday 1, it's goalless between Derby and Reading, it's Huddersfield Town 0, Norwich 0, also goalless in the matches between Millwall and Stoke, Preston and Swansea, and QPR and Nottingham Forest. This is Off the Ball Saturday on News Talk 5-3-1-0-6 for your Premier League predictions. Back after this.
Football on Off the Ball
with Paddy Power, fueling the mischief in the beautiful game. Gamble responsibly. CWE.net.
Andrew, welcome back to Off the Ball Saturday here on News Talk. John Duggan with you through until 5 o'clock in the company of the former Republic of Ireland defender Gary Breen and the broadcaster and journalist Johnny Ward and the football correspondent of the Irish Independent, Dan McDonnell. So it's Crystal Palace 1, Southampton 0 in the Premier League, 3 o'clock kickoff. Wilfred Zaha with the goal for Palace, the Eagles in the first half. Earlier on, Arsenal beat Fulham by 3-0. We're asking people for their Premier League predictions. Mike and Leash has been untouched on 5-3-1-0-6. Top four, Liverpool, Man United, Chelsea, Man City. Dyche to be gone first. Everton to finish fifth to me is a surprise. And the bottom three, Burnley, Brighton and West Ham United. Manchester United, Gary, Donny van de Beek has signed, which is a good signing from Ajax. Yeah. Unbeaten in 14 top flight matches towards the end of last season. We're not talking about Solskjaer anymore in terms of his position, which is obviously good for him. But have they done enough in terms of defenders and maybe a holding midfielder for you to be challengers?
Not in terms of centre-half. I do believe they need to strengthen that area. I still maintain that's a vulnerability about them, certainly in terms of you can get at both those centre-halves in different scenarios. I don't think they have a dominant presence like Van Dijk. I know that type of centre-half is so difficult to come by. But you're right as well, John, to identify that midfield, that holding role, how important it is to protect centre-halves who are not capable of looking after business themselves on their own without a little bit of a screen in front. And Donny van de Beek is a great signing. He really is. I saw his development coming through at Ajax. And the pathway that was created for him there initially when David Klaassen was the captain of Ajax was averaging a goal every two games from midfield. And yet they moved him on to create space for Donny van de Beek to come through. And he's shown what a quality player he is. So all his strengths will be attacking. So if you're thinking about him, Pogba and Bruno Fernandes, then you are looking at a midfield that could be vulnerable out of possession. But certainly going forward, they will be very difficult to stop, bearing in mind the attacking options they have as well. But I think you're right. I think a lot has been made recently about Manchester United not getting their business done quick enough, efficiently enough, that all their potential signings have dragged on. And certainly looking at that defence, I still think they're one top-class centre-half short of really trying to make a challenge for the title.
Yeah, like it's just Sancho all the time. Sancho talk, guys. Why does it always have to be just on one person, one player, and especially an attacking player when Gary's making the points he's making? I don't really get that. You know, what can you have a few fronts, a few maybe they don't have the money or whatever, but Chelsea don't seem to have a problem with it.
Yeah, I mean, like I don't know. I mean, like it's clearly a player that they want, and sometimes these sagas are like protracted affairs, and there's a bit of like brinkmanship going on with it. But I don't know. Like it's obviously a lot of focus on their off-field practices in recent years, and I mean, in some respects, you know, they've improved a lot in terms of the profile of player they've gone after, and you know, there was. You know, their whole scouting area and, you know, in the post-Ferguson years come under real scrutiny. And, I mean, they're probably going after the right profile of player. But, you know, Dortmund obviously had a reasonably strong hand in terms of being able to manage it. I mean, they might have had other irons in the fire privately. I don't know if that's the case. But it's clear, like, they have a clear focus. And maybe in this sort of pandemic transfer market, things aren't going to happen quickly. Maybe people thought initially naively that, you know, the figures wouldn't be as inflated, but clearly at the, you know, the top end, you know, there's still, you know, an ability for like the top clubs to still pay and hold out for like large amounts of money. But I don't know, like they have a clear target and purpose in mind. There's no suggestion that anyone else is going to gazump them on it. So you're sort of waiting for it to happen eventually. But it's just slow. But maybe the year that's in it, people are slightly more understanding of it.
What's your feeling, Johnny, on how United will do this season?
I think the Van de Beek sign is interesting because they do need a really top sitting midfielder, and you know, McTominay wasn't great post lockdown, and maybe put a bit more emphasis on Matic, who kind of had a little bit of a renaissance. I think he signed a new deal after that. I still think Man United, I tend to agree with Gary, defensively they're probably slightly lacking that one top player. The Maguire thing isn't really, I don't think that's going to be relevant. I think their strength will be more or less playing on the break. I think they have extremely good players on the break, right up there with anyone really in the league, once they get it right. And if Pogba can have a big season, it's just... There was that question mark, and which they sort of answered after lockdown, where they started to beat the poor teams quite routinely. That has been a problem for them, but I think Solskjaer's done an okay job. You know, he didn't have an awful lot of experience in terms of Cardiff and Malden and whatever going in there. But I like the team he's put together. He seems to be handling, you know, the egos in the dressing room quite well. Pogba looked a lot happier post lockdown, and I think they will need him to have an outstanding season if they are to challenge for the title, which I don't think is completely out of the question. But I think in terms of just the Fernandes and the quality that they have in attack and in attacking situations, I think they will be they're the dark horses for the league in my view.
And Gary, you got Rashford 17 goals last season, Greenwood in 18 goals in all competitions, just whatever about what, you know, the issue during the week or whatever, we'll soon move on from that. You got De Gea now with pressure on him with Dean Henderson. But like going up front, like it, they're very, very exciting. The Fernandes was a game changer, complete game changer for them from January onwards.
It was incredible because you think about Brighton coming on, they're losing at home to Burnley. And it's just one player that you feel just links the whole team. He just immediately came in and looked like he had that confidence to deal with being a Manchester United player. Too many players since Ferguson's era have gone to United because of their ability. Certainly, there's no doubt about that. You don't go there if you can't play football. But not having that mentality to cope with the pressures of playing for Manchester United. And he certainly did. Listen, let's not forget, towards the end, he looked like he was out on his feet. He was burnt out. So this break, I'm not sure if it will be long enough for him, but you hope that it is enough for him to recharge his batteries. But certainly going forward, they're going to be dynamic. They really will be. But you're right. I think that's such a fascinating dynamic, that goalkeeping situation. It really is, because De Gea had some real difficulties last year. Looked a shadow of himself, to be perfectly honest. Now, suddenly you've got young Buck coming into the building, Henderson. He's not going to be happy there being number two. And it will be massive scrutiny now if De Gea makes any mistake. You know what's going to happen. Straight away, they're going to be looking at Henderson. Now, he's been impressive at Sheffield United. He really has. But again, I'll talk about that mentality. And this is with the greatest respect to Sheffield United and lesser teams as such. But when you play for Manchester United, the spotlight is on you like no other club, really, certainly in goal. So I think it'll be a test of his ability to deal with a situation where he makes mistakes. Obviously, that there was a high-profile one against Liverpool for Sheffield United in that game early on in last season. And he recovered well from it. Chris Wilder, brilliant manager, said, listen, it's a bad mistake. And if you keep making them, you don't get to be the top goalkeeper that you want to be. The only thing looking at that scenario with Henderson that really caught my eye is that you think about De Gea, the struggles he's had, but then think about Jordan Pickford as well. And yet both goalkeepers got the nod ahead of him. They, or certainly De Gea will start the season ahead of United, and Pickford has started the season ahead of him for England. So I'm not sure if everyone is that convinced at this stage by Henderson, despite showing what a good goalkeeper he is.
I just want to read out a statement we got in here from a GAA. The GAA's Ord Corla held a meeting online earlier today where it was decided to formally proceed with plans to stage the All-Ireland Senior Under-20 and Minor Intercounty Football and Hurling Championships for 2020. The decision was made following positive interaction with the government and understanding that specific financial supports will be made available. Due to the reduced level of funding available as a result of the pandemic, a series of strict financial controls will be put in place by the association, which will govern the costs and preparation of teams. London, Warwickshire and Lancashire will not be involved in the 2020 championships. The special emergency powers for the administration of the association have been reapproved and extended until December the 4th. Manchester City lads, Nathan Ake has joined, but he's not Lionel Messi. Guardiola, is he happy? Is he happy, Gary, with where he's at with City at the moment? It was just pretty brittle mentally the way they kind of folded tamely against Arsenal in the Cup and then Lyon in the Champions League.
Yeah, that was a massive concern. You felt that this was their real opportunity for that Champions League. And as Johnny said, to go out as meekly as they did was just incredible, really. Nathan Ake is a good signing, but I don't think it solves the problems they have at centre-half. I'm not convinced that they've identified him to go in at centre-half, to be perfectly honest. We saw him playing for Holland last week at left-back. He has that ability. And certainly if he plays left-back for Guardiola, he'll be more comfortable coming centrally into that midfield position where the left-backs do, certainly more comfortable doing that than a Mendy who wants that space in those wide areas. But he's a good player. I genuinely believe that he is. But it'll be an interesting dynamic to have Ake and Laporte as two left-footed centre-halves. Now, people will think, well, what difference does it make? But it's so rare in football that you get two left-footers. I don't think any of them would probably have played on the right side of defence throughout their careers, to be perfectly honest, even coming up as young players, because there's so few left-footed players as such.
On that, Gary, does that suggest that he like desperately wanted a centre-half? Because obviously with Guardiola, that's going to be a big issue for him. Everything's about, yeah, like, the, you know, so does that just suggest that he really, really badly wanted a centre-half or what?
I think he's always wanted Ake. I think he's liked him. I do know that from what people tell me, he's liked him. But I think it's probably his versatility that he can play in at left-back, centre-half. He can even play holding midfield. He's comfortable doing it. Did it as a young player at Chelsea coming through the ranks. And he's a threat. He's a real threat at set pieces. He's not that 6'4", 6'5", dominating centre-half, but he certainly jumps like one. But I don't know. I just look at, if I think about Manchester City and in terms of like getting back and challenging Liverpool, closing the gap that they had of 18 points, then I don't worry about them going forward. They outscored Liverpool comfortably last season. You think about the quality that they have. It's the one standout problem that they have, and that's at centre-half. As soon as Laporte got injured early last season, you feared for them in their title challenge. It totally changed the whole complexion of that Manchester City team. It genuinely did. In a way, and we keep saying it, if Van Dijk gets injured for Liverpool, it will for them as well. They're that important, both those two centre-halves. So it's good that he's back healthy. I know he's got the COVID situation at the moment, but you hope he recover quickly from that. But I still think, as Dan said earlier, this transfer window is still open. I expect Manchester City to do big business. And if they were to get that Koulibaly from Napoli, who I haven't seen that much of, but anyone I speak to who have seen him said he's that dominant centre-half that they desperately need. So if they can do that, then I think we've got a proper title fight on our hands then.
Cork City 0, Shamrock Rovers 2. Aaron Green with both goals. Going to go 8 points clear at the top. Looking good for Rovers there.
It's great ahead of the AC Milan game. They've just gone 3-0 up there, actually. And that looks to be a goal from... That's Lafferty. So, Ferrugia, who's come off the bench, actually. They've just kind of had a great season, JD. And, you know, the game's been televised, obviously, next week. I think it's a good showpiece for the best football team in the League of Ireland to take on the likes of Zlatan and so forth. And they've gone in with a very much like confidence kind of, not confidence boosting, but they'll go in and very, very buoyant because they've absolutely bossed the game. The bits I saw before we came on air, and they were 2-0 up at halftime, and they've real strength and depth. And maybe in the second half of the show as well, we'll talk about young players coming up because Kevin Deppy at 15 is just, the only thing is that he's 15 and you don't want to be putting too much pressure on a kid. But the Rovers project is a great story.
It's a shame, Dan, isn't it, that they don't have any crowds and they don't have the TV cut that they possibly would have had given what's happening, you know, with AC Milan. Like, how often do you get a team like that coming to Dublin?
I know. It's 10 years since they played Juventus, and you know, even I did both of those games, even the away leg over in actually it was moved out of Turin for some reason, but you know, Del Piero, like 98th minute, stunning goal. And even just, it's more like the stories that those players carry with them, you know, in years to come, you know, that they played against this. Now, they're still going to be able to say they played against, you know, Zlatan or whatever squad AC Milan bring, but maybe it's about your friends and your family and, you know, the away game and going to the, you know, going over there, going to Milan and playing a game and stuff. So, yeah, it's strange, but I mean, I suppose it's a product of the year that we're in, and it's still, I think, going to be a big event come Thursday, but just in a very, very different way. It's like the Premier League, like Everton, it's so much of a made-for-TV event. You can only imagine, like, you know, people with Leeds who've been craving this for years, and they're all now, you know, making plans of sort of going to houses or doing whatever, you know, to prepare for that. And it's not how you envisage it, but I mean, we're still grateful to have sport compared to those long months where we didn't have it at all. But it's typical. The one year you draw a game like that, you can't necessarily profit in the way that you normally would. But you know,
the other thing is, Dan, though, in fairness, like they more or less fluked their way to get to this round in the first place, and the game, I think you've said this, the game would probably be in Tala, so it wouldn't be a massive money earner, and it'll still be, like, I think TV wise, I think there'll be a huge audience, like, and the Rovers players will be conscious of that. So I'm kind of trying to be a glass half full person, but maybe because I got accreditation for the game, I'm just like happy to be there. But
don't be that person, Johnny. Don't be that person.
No, please. I don't think it's not going to cost them probably as much as people would think, and I think the TV audience is going to be enormous.
Just on City, Gary. Just to go back to that, Raheem Sterling, does he have any improvement in him? Like, I always think that Raheem Sterling, despite that miss against Lyon, has got potential really to be like the top player in the league, you know. Is there anything left in him, or has he been at his peak the last couple of years for you?
I think he's been brilliant over the last couple of seasons. What noticeable is how confident he is in front of goal. You're right, so he still has those glaring misses at times, but nowhere near as many as he used to do. A lot of work's been done on that, is in terms of that calmness in front of goal. But even at his age, I think any player is still going to improve under Guardiola. I think he demands that. I don't think anyone's allowed to just stop and not look to go on to bigger and better performances. Whether or not he can be the best player in the league, I don't know, because of the fact that one of his teammates is head and shoulders above everyone, in my opinion, in Kevin De Bruyne. I think very few players can play at the level that he hits when he's on the top of his game. But Sterling's become a leader, not only for Manchester City, but even for that England team, to be perfectly honest. And he's a player who has been incredible, really. In terms of what he's done on the field is amazing, but what he's doing off it is incredible as well, in terms of taking on the British press and stuff like that, in terms of how young black players are perceived. So he's a real role model, and I don't even know him, but I'm proud of what he's achieved as a player and as a person. He's incredible.
So where do you see City fitting into the title picture, Gary?
Well, as I just said, I think it's a massive... I don't think that centre-half problem's been solved. And if it isn't, I don't care how good you are going forward, you can't win titles. It's as simple as that. We talked about the influence of how many players they have going forward, the goals that they can get. That's great. And strikers and midfielders, they can win you games. But defenders, defences, they win you leagues. And that's the difference. You don't have Van Dijk at Liverpool, they don't win the league. It's simple as that. And I think that they have to try and find someone who has that type of presence there. And I think they're going to have to go in the market to get it. £40 million for Nathan Ake is a good signing. I think it is, in terms of flexibility he gives you within that squad. But I don't think he solves the problem that was so glaringly obvious last year. They just cannot defend.
Yeah, it's half-time in the game between Crystal Palace and Southampton, and we got the report from Mike Lawrence.
Crystal Palace 1, Southampton 0. Wilfried Zaha may be the subject of transfer speculation again this summer, and he may have added a bit more to his value with a well-taken goal on the 13th minute, volleying home an Andros Townsend cross from the right-hand side. The goal came against the run of play after Southampton had started brightly. Danny Ings, an early threat after just missing out on that Golden Boot award last season. The goal brought Palace to life. They grew in confidence. Crystal Palace 1, Southampton 0.
We've got to take a break because we're back with Gary Breen, Dan McDonald and Johnny Ward on the Premier League season preview in a moment. Just to go through the scores in the Championship as well, just let you know that Rovers, by the way, Shamrock Rovers 3-0 up away to Cork City, going to go 8 points clear at the top of the League of Ireland Premier Division. So Arsenal beat Fulham 3-0 earlier on with goals from Alexander Lacazette, Gabriel, the new defender, and the third one from Pierre-Emerick Aubameyang. Earlier on in the Championship, it finished Birmingham City 1, Brentford 0. And finished as well, Wycombe Wanderers 0, Rotherham United 1. Their other matches have all reached half-time. So it's Bournemouth 1, Blackburn Rovers 1, Barnsley 0, Luton Town 0, Bristol City 1, Coventry City 1, Cardiff City 0, Sheffield Wednesday 2, Derby County 0, Reading 2, Huddersfield Town 0, Norwich City 0, Millwall 0, Stoke City 0. Also goalless in the games between Preston North End and Swansea City and QPR and Nottingham Forest. And just to let you know, in the racing sphere, we had the Matron Stakes there at 3:10, that was won by Champers Elysee at 9-2, and the Juvenile Stakes, the Group 2 at Leopardstown, the last race there has gone to Cadillac, the 11-8 favourite, trained by Jessica Harrington and ridden by Shane Foley. We'll also have the latest update on the Champion Stakes, which goes to post at 4:10. This is Off the Ball Saturday on News Talk 53106 for your text messages. Back after the news, don't go away.
You're welcome back to Off the Ball Saturday here on News Talk. John Duggan with you 3 to 5 o'clock in the company to speak football. With the former Republic of Ireland international defender Gary Breen, the football correspondent of the Irish Independent Dan McDonald, and the broadcaster and journalist Johnny Ward. Remember, our football coverage brought to you with thanks to Paddy Power. For more information on responsible gambling, visit dunlewy.net. You can text us 53106. You can tweet us at Off the Ball. You can also watch us on the social channels. We're streaming live as well for Periscope on Twitter, at Off the Ball on YouTube, on Facebook, and on the new OTB Sports app. Download that now for iOS and Android by searching OTB Sports in your app store. We are previewing the Premier League season, which has begun with a win for Arsenal at Fulham 3-0 earlier on, and Crystal Palace leading Southampton by a goal to nil. So we've done Liverpool, United and City and Arsenal after their win. Chelsea, lads, Gary, with all the signings they've made, Roman Abramovich spending money like it's 2004, what constitutes success or failure for Lampard?
Well, I think they need to be challenging. Certainly need to bridge the gap between the top two. But people talk about more pressure on Frank Lampard now than he's ever had before. Frank Lampard has had pressure his whole life. Initially being a young player at West Ham, where I had lads who were there, apprentices, saying he only got the contract because his family was involved at West Ham. Then he has to prove the West Ham faithful that they don't really take to him for the same reason. Goes to Chelsea in a big money signing. Same again. Keep having to prove himself. And again, as a manager, so he's under no illusions in terms of, everyone said it was a free hit last year. It wasn't. That was an audition as such, because if he didn't look to do as well as he did last year, he wouldn't have kept the job, despite the fact that he's a club legend. But certainly that investment now of like in excess of £200 million at a time when money's not easy to find for so many clubs, it does certainly put the spotlight on him. There's no doubt about that. But people forget that they had £140 million from the Hazard-Morata sale, the fact that they could save up money from being inactive in two transfer windows, so they were able to. They were always going to come big with the money this time. But the signings have been good, I think. I think there's a potential there now to solve the problems that they had last year. Yes, there were some positives, but some real negatives in that they couldn't break down teams at home. The teams down the bottom, it was a familiar tale, the likes of West Ham going there, Bournemouth. I've seen it so often in terms of teams sitting back, Chelsea not having the ability, despite all those gifted players, to break them down. Now, if you look at their signing, Ziyech, as I said to you before, I've seen a lot of Ajax over the last few years. He has that ability. Coming off that right-hand side, left-footed, can make a pass. Havertz is the same in terms of the chances he'll create. And then you think about Timo Werner, who just continually attacks from that left-hand side, from out to in, and always getting into those goal-scoring positions. Add those then to the players that they have in the likes of Pulisic, Mount. I know the likes of Willian, Pedro have left, but probably their time was, or certainly their best time was behind them. So it does look like they do have now the armoury to really go deep in terms of challenging at the top. The problem that he did have, and I'd always counter this in terms of successful Chelsea teams, were based on how good they were defensively at centre-half. And certainly the players that they've had at the moment, in terms of Kurt Zouma, Tomori, the young centre-half, never convinced me that they were good enough to put Chelsea up where they believe they belong, challenging for titles. Thiago Silva now comes in, gives them that experience. I know he's at 35, but I still think he'll have a massive influence on them now. And you hope now that N'Golo Kante stays fit and healthy in a way that he wasn't last year. I think they will be able to close the gap. Whether or not it's good enough to challenge how relentlessly consistent City and Liverpool have been remains to be seen.
Yeah, Dan and Johnny, I'm just wondering how quickly all these players can gel under Lampard.
Well, I think that's the question. Like, it goes back to our point earlier about sort of momentum and everything and the expectation and the scrutiny, you know, on their spending, that they really do probably need to start well just to avoid sort of that commentary. People just now just want to reach conclusions after 2, 3, 4 games, you know. Mm. And again, look, I know that's just noise, and if you're mentally strong, you know you won't react to that anyway, and it's just talking heads like us going on about those type of things. But I suppose it's natural that of the players that Gary listed, the newer players there, that they're not all going to click. You know, some of them, I mean, I'm really looking forward to seeing Kai Havertz on a more regular basis. Yeah. I mean, Kenny Cunningham was raving about him during the week. I don't think I've ever heard Kenny so excited about a player. It's like, Kenny, this is where you normally find a flaw. You know, this is like, where's the flaw? And he wasn't necessarily finding one. So, like, but at the same time, there's you know, there will be issues, I'm sure, at one of these signings that it won't happen. I mean, you even see with, like, Pulisic eventually was finding his stride. And they've had all these growing pains with Mount and with Abraham and various players. So there's a lot of reason to be convinced. Now, obviously, with Kante, there seems to be some suggestion he still could leave. And I don't know where that goes. And again, like, is that tied in with other prospective deals? And you know, if he does go, you know, what they've had Jorginho there, but like, who's going to be maybe their number? I suppose their number six to use the term that people use now. Like, is there a plan that, is it a Declan Rice, or is there something happening that we are not aware of in the background that's influencing some of this speculation? That's obviously a key area of the team if you're going to try and control games and feed the players that we've discussed. So again, that's a pretty significant asterisk around Chelsea, but I think they're going to be very good to watch, and there's certainly reason to believe that they could have a much better season. But again, their business in the last couple of weeks is going to be possibly very significant for them.
I think that what Gary referenced in terms of Lampard, he was under scrutiny last season, and, you know, he got that job based on what he did at Derby, which isn't good enough for anyone to get the job, apart from the fact that he had this, you know, amazing Chelsea career. And it's always something that I think, well, you know, Solskjaer never gets the Man United job because unless he had that career, and it's probably a spurious enough connection, but he was under scrutiny, and I think he did a nice job because he had to, his hand was forced with the players he had to an extent. They seemed to play for him, and I think the Kante situation is going to be interesting because the goals concession last season was the worst in something like 25 years, but a lot of that was down to the fact that, you know, arguably the best defensive midfielder in the world or whatever, he's either not playing well or he's injured. And that's going to be key. I think that's probably every bit as important as the defensive personnel that they have, because attackingly they'll be absolutely fine.
But the massive thing for that Chelsea scenario as well, we didn't mention, is the goalkeeping situation. Kepa's just not good enough. Just doesn't make saves. It's incredible in terms of the Opta stats, is that he's conceded 11 goals more than he should have done. He doesn't make routine saves. And when you think about that huge investment in excess of £70 million, it's incredible. So that has to be addressed. I know there's talk of Mendy coming in from Rennes and stuff like that, but they definitely need to solve that problem. Because like you just said there, John, don't care how good you are in midfield defensive, don't care how good you are as a back four. If your goalkeeper don't make saves, you've got no chance. But just on that as well about Frank Lampard, I think football management has become very bespoke now. And I think it's something we're seeing all the time. You're right, Solskjaer doesn't get that job with his CV. It's just that he fits Manchester United in terms of, and likewise Lampard, likewise with Arteta as well, because their CVs don't allow him to have that job. But we've seen it again with the likes of Southgate getting the England manager's job. To a certain extent, you can say that, well, I said initially that Stephen Kenny doesn't have the CV to be the Ireland manager. But the bespoke nature of what is needed right now suggests, yeah, he probably is the right man to have it. So that's how football management has changed now. You just don't tick it off as like to say, well, he's done a 2 years there, 3 years there, 4 years there, 5 years and been successful. Now he can get the big jobs. I think it's just got to be the right man for the right club.
Is that the way it always was, though, Gary? Has that changed in your view that it's now you actually have to tailor a manager to a certain club? When I'm thinking of Solskjaer, I'm thinking of club legend. But I'm also thinking of the people around him like Mike Phelan, you know?
Yeah, but look at either scenario. Like, if you think about like Manchester United manager Alex Ferguson, look at the history of success that he had at Aberdeen. You know, he's broke that Old Firm monopoly. He's challenging in Europe with Aberdeen. Then he gets the Man United job. You know, before, it was a case of, well, what's your CV? Does it warrant it? Certainly when you get national jobs, you normally have to have a backlog of real quality work to get it now. But I do think it's different. I think it's important now that we've seen, and we've seen so many managers fail because the fit isn't right, regardless of their unbelievable CV. So I just think that the bespoke nature of football management now is this guy the right fit for our club or at the right time now for this national team?
As a Spurs fan, I'm not hopeful under Jose, lads. They got a bit more steel in there with Højbjerg and Doherty. Obviously, we'll get on to you wrote a column on it today, Dan. Harry Kane, he's got to stay injury-free, but they don't have enough talent to me in the team to be top four contenders, which is a real shame. Spurs, to me, they blew their chance. They blew their chance a few years ago when they had it with Pochettino 16-17, and it's not going to be pretty for me.
Well, that's pretty bleak.
Gary, do you have a different
view? It's the Tottenham. That's the Tottenham, isn't it? Every fan, even when they were flying at the time, no one believed they could actually win the league that season. And John, you think about that last season at White Hart Lane. We've had conversations about this before. They were sensational. No one could lay a glove on them at White Hart Lane. I remember Guardiola going there. He's made on his first season. Manchester City had won all their games. Tottenham probably put on one of the best performances I've ever seen from a team live. They blew them apart. But you're right. There's a window of opportunity there for clubs. And Tottenham did not take advantage of it. They really didn't. To lose the league that year to... Actually, they're in a two-horse race with Leicester and they finished third.
Yeah.
So that's typical Tottenham. No wonder that your fans hold your heads down as such. I'm looking at the scenario. Everyone talks about the quality that Mourinho has in his second seasons at clubs. They'll be more organised. They'll be more akin to how he wants them to play because of the fact they'll have time to work on them. No club has had enough of a pre-season really to work on what they want to do. So all the teams have to hit the ground running. But you're right, there are a couple of astute signings. Matt Doherty for £15 million. That's a great bit of business. It really is. I'll be fascinated to see how he does at Tottenham because he'll play slightly different. I know, John, you'll know more than anyone, the lopsided nature of how they attack. That left back kind of narrows up like a centre-half to allow that right-hand side, Aurier, last season to bomb on. So you'd hope that Doherty will be playing in a similar type of position as a wing-back, but I don't expect Jose Mourinho to be playing free at the back.
Dan, having gone through the weeds and your piece today in the Irish Independent with Matt Doherty, do you believe it's a good move for him?
I think you had to take the chance. I think it's one of those where he'd die wondering if he didn't. You know, time will tell, really, if it was the right move. But I think... There's sometimes a sense, you know, I think I made this point a couple of weeks back, you know, Seamus Coleman maybe didn't look for the move when he could have looked for the move and maybe now looks back and thinks maybe, you know, maybe he could have taken that opportunity when it popped up. And of course, there are many reasons to be fearful about what might happen to Spurs and what might happen with the manager. And then, you've been brought in by someone else and it can all change very quickly when he had, you know, Nuno and Wolves and a way of playing that really suited his style and strengths. And I completely appreciate all of that. But at the same time, it's a chance to go to, I suppose, like for all their flaws, like a genuine top six club. It's a chance to, you know, to really go to like that wonderful stadium, to have the expectation, even with as good as Wolves have been, there's the sort of quirks around the sort of the relationship of Jorge Mendes and the club and you know the proliferation of clients belonging to him that are there, and you always wonder will this Wolves thing last in the way that you might expect, and Spurs, will there be more juice in their sort of long-term standing? But he had to give it a go. I mean, Matt's story is brilliant. I went into it today. Like, he is someone who grew up in a time in the schoolboy football scene in Dublin, which on reflection was a very competitive and strong era of players, not all of whom reached their potential. You know, like Matt was born in January 1992, the same month as Robbie Brady and Jeff Hendrick. And when Matt was a kid at Belvedere, he didn't even play right back because there was a kid called Lee Swords who was, you know, one of the big names. And Matt was shunted around different positions and went to Bowes from Belvedere with a load of players, the likes of Chris Forrester, who's been over to England. Didn't really happen for Chris. He's come home. He has all the ability in the world. The likes of Roberto Lopez, who's at Shamrock Rovers now. Guys who've had excellent League of Ireland careers. And then some other lads who I spoke to who drifted out of football completely, doing other things in life. And Matt, like, was almost in the middle of that group. And maybe he had this sort of, like, carefree, lax demeanour, this not very serious demeanour that led to him being probably underestimated a bit by people who sort of might have thought he wasn't their cup of tea on the basis of maybe one or two meetings. But he always had, by speaking to people who play with him, a real inner belief and drive in himself in what he wanted to do, and actually played in a very similar style. Like, he always played these little 1-2s. He always had this, he just carried himself in a particular way that has probably, from speaking to people who know him a long time, they reckon that this temperament he's had has allowed him to survive in the game for so long that he doesn't really get that flustered. He doesn't get too, you know, caught up in anything. And you hope that that temperament stays with him now as he goes to probably the next level of expectation, the next level of scrutiny, that he can hopefully keep that personality that he's always had. Like, there is this story, like, Matt famously played in it was a friendly against Wolves, which basically got him the move. That Bowes were actually going through a really stressful time and the club was, like, financially in bother. And it's a great story that a year later, or say 10 years later, they're now getting, like, you know, close to 1.5 million from Matt. But, like, he basically played in this friendly with Wolves, and there was two centre halves playing, experienced centre halves, Mark Rossiter and Jason McGuinness. And, like, Matt was probably didn't play that well against Wolves. He kept getting the wrong side of his marker, the wrong side of the winger. And Mark Rossiter was getting completely, you know, sorry, Jason McGuinness was getting completely wound up and was shouting over at Matt Doherty, this 17, 18-year-old kid, saying, listen, you're the wrong side, you're the wrong side. And Matt Doherty turns around and sort of makes just, like, phone gesture with his hand and says, I hear you, relax, relax. And Jason McGuinness is cracking up. You know, this kid just, like, you know, what's going on? Like, you know, tune into it. But, like, Mick McCarthy saw enough that day, having been told about him beforehand, to come back and watch Matt play against Aston Villa a week later. He was exceptional against Ashley Young. And I suppose the rest is history. And it's, like, it's a great modern success story that someone who was probably pigeonholed, you know, as a maybe championship player for a long period of time, but he's eventually just, you know, a lot of things maybe came together for him, that the change of era and climate at Wolves really suited him. I know he improved his diet, a lot of stuff, but there's actually raw materials that go back to his early days that stand to him now. And I really enjoyed speaking to some people who knew him back then, who could see maybe what not everyone saw, but we are now getting a chance to see it.
Magical, by the way, has won the Irish Champion Stakes 9-2. Aidan O'Brien and Shamie Heffernan.
Yeah, I don't know if we're talking about the relevance of a crowd, but in terms of home advantage, Ballydoyle certainly enjoyed home advantage today, because Gaeth was just beaten by Ballydoyle team tactics, just like effectively Fantastic Light beat Galileo in terms of probably getting their tactics right in 2001. Gaeth was, it was the only danger, I think, to his chance of winning today, was that he'd be pestered up front by Armory, and they played it to an absolute T, and he's gone home absolutely sulking, because he knows he should be beating Magical as he did last time, but he didn't, because he was playing away from home, and it still matters in racing anyway.
Gary, what Dan is saying there about Matt Doherty is very interesting. It's just all between the ears is where it's so crucial, isn't it?
Oh, yeah, of course it is, in terms of players. And we've seen how many times we've seen young players with great talent and they don't fulfil their destiny as such. But I haven't read Dan's piece today. I look forward to reading it. I always enjoy his work. But when I look at Matt Doherty, in terms of, we're not even talking about, say, a player who's a good Premier League player. He is an exceptional Premier League player in terms of how he's playing. He's like reinventing that right wing back role, because normally you associate him with real width, high, but he gets that ball, drives in, goes in. More often than not, he's alongside Jimenez at centre forward. And the way he does it is brilliant, because I look at him and, in akin to what Dan said there, he does play at his own pace. You're thinking, at times he's jogging, at times he's walking. You watch him play, it's incredible. And yet, for Wolves, he always seems to be in that attacking area, and yet he always seems to be back in his defensive area as well. And you're looking at that and thinking, well, can he replicate that with Ireland? No, I don't think you can, because of the way they set up balls. They've got two centre midfielders, I said this so many times, who hold the ball in Neves and Moutinho, who are far better at retaining possession than any of our midfield players for the national team. Then align the fact that it's a three at the back situation. So when he does get back, he can reattach quickly to that defensive unit because there's three centre-halves. Now, I think it's unfair on Matt, to be perfectly honest. And I think it has been unfair on him, because he excels in the Premier League for Wolves. And to think that he can just replicate that in an Ireland shirt without those people around him is so difficult. I think it's near on impossible, to be perfectly honest. But I do believe that he had to make that move to Tottenham. It's a massive move. Of course it is, because as Dan said there, you go to Wolves as a young player. And if I give you a little bit of an insight, when you turn up as a young player at a club, they always kind of think of you as that young player who turned up. You never really have a stature of someone who comes in as a 25-year-old bought. And I know that they probably have looked after him financially and improved his contract, continue as he's proved what a good player he is. But I can imagine he's gone to Tottenham and his wages reflect now how good a player he is in the Premier League. And I think he has to do it for that reason alone. Let me ask you a question, John. Do you think Tottenham will finish ahead of Wolves this year?
Yes, but not ahead of Arsenal, which is the real issue, you know.
This is the problem. This is the inferiority complex that all you Tottenham supporters have. All you're obsessed about is Arsenal. Concentrate on your own game.
We're saying Tottenham's Day, or whatever they call it. I can't even pronounce it. You know, that's always been a real bane of my life. But the last few years, we got rid of that, and now it's back. But the thing about Wolves is, Wolves only used 21 players last season, and they don't have the Europa League anymore. Wolves could do really well this season. They've signed a young lad from Porto for over 30 million as well.
I think not having that extra fatigue of the Europa League is massive. I really do. I think that's a massive one. I think a lot of those teams who are playing in the Europa League, we know Mourinho said, listen, I've played in it twice, I've won it twice. But I think it will tax any of those squads in it. It's a really demanding schedule at the best of times, let alone in this condensed season.
So Shane Duffy scored on his debut for Celtic against Ross County 3-0, which is great.
Listen, I called it. If he doesn't get double figures, I'll be amazed.
He'll score 20 this season.
Listen, he's so dominant. He's so, in terms of the Matt Doherty scenario, in terms of the effect it's had on Shane Duffy, I think it's been billed as a real negative, as if like Matt Doherty shouldn't play. What I'd identified is that it'll be a different challenge for Shane Duffy in terms of defending deep on the edge of his box under O'Neill, having loads of our having all 10 of our players virtually on top of him, no space to do anything. You can't get around Shane at the best of times, let alone when he's got 10 teammates around him. But I think that going to Celtic, I think it's a massive move for him. For Celtic, I think it's a brilliant signing for them. I think he can go down as a legend in this quest for their 10 in a row. And I think he'll get double figures. I genuinely do. And for you to say he scored on his first game, no surprise.
Do you think his place is secure, Gary, in the Ireland team? We'll say if Daryl O'Shea has like a very good start season. I don't know where Daryl O'Shea is going to be playing if he starts the season for West Brom. I know he's been playing a lot back. The problem with Duffy, I think he'd five or six chances in the two Kenny games alone. He had three chances in Bulgaria, possibly should have scored one of the other two, and had maybe a couple of chances. But he was very, very poor defensively, I thought. He just looked, and I think he referenced this at the end of both games, he wasn't happy with his performance. And obviously, you can say what you want about him on the ball. Like, maybe he's not as bad as some people think. Maybe it doesn't matter as much, maybe whatever. But like, he just needs to probably up his game defensively, I think.
Well, Johnny, in terms of that, right, because I think it's a bit of a lazy assumption that he won't be able to play that high line. I've never said that he won't be able to do it. I just felt that it's a different challenge to him. And if you're asking me, can he do it? I believe he can do it. Because if you talk about him going in the Premier League, he's playing against top-class centre-forwards all the time. Now, I know under Chris Hughton, they defended deeper, but under Potter, it was higher. So he can cope against these players. I've no doubt about that. But there has to be context in that. That was a pre-season game for him. He's playing for his country, which is effectively a pre-season game in terms of where they are fitness levels. Now, centre-halves, by the very nature, and I'm telling you this through experience, take longer to get that fitness in terms of your movements, having to go quickly up to press the centre-forward, then spinning behind.
And he looked like that anyway, didn't he?
Yeah, look at the size of him. It's going to take him games. It would have taken the likes of Richard Dunn. They're those type of centre-halves who are tipping the scales at maybe 14, 15 stone as opposed to me at 13 stone. It's a massive difference. So he was always going to be sluggish. But I think that it's been too quick to say, like, oh, he's vulnerable now. Can he make the adjustment in terms of playing the high line? Yes, of course he can. Because every challenge that he has faced, bear it in mind, that horrific injury he got, he comes back stronger. He goes to the Championship with Brighton, they get promoted. Then everyone's saying, can he do it in the Premier League? Yes, he can. Because he hasn't been embarrassed by any centre-forwards in the Premier League. My big concern is that I think it's a brilliant move for Celtic. I genuinely do. I think that he'll get double figures in goals. I said that. I think he'd be a legend up there in a 10-in-a-row season. My big concern for Ireland is the quality of player that he's playing against, and that he does get into a little bit of bad habits, not because he's lazy, because I don't think that, but that he's not up against quality centre-forwards. Every centre-forward, there's no centre-forward in Scotland who would play in a Premier League team, none. So he's going to be playing against lesser quality, and that's the concern, because even the likes of Van Dijk come down to Southampton from Celtic with dreadful habits in terms of losing the ball, but not getting into those positions quickly enough, because he didn't have to in Celtic, because they're not good enough to punish you.
I think the interesting thing, I mean, it's not to be making excuses, but the one thing I would say about the Irish games, and like Doherty and Duffy were both, you know, pretty below par, I think.
Yeah.
You know, and even from doing this piece on Matt the last week, you know, Matt was going through a transfer situation. He was on holiday not long before the games.
Yeah.
And like is very much in pre-season mode. Shane Duffy did the two games. He'd started one game since February. And you know, he's been through a sort of a tough time. He lost his dad and he would have had the uncertainty of the move, the transfers. So I think, like, both Doherty and Duffy, there are reasons to believe that, like, they will be better, you know, in a month's time. They're, like, Duffy is going to play regularly now. We can see that. You would assume Doherty will too. So I think, like, but I also very, like, I was, you know, listening to Gary's analysis about the potential issue between Doherty and Duffy, and there's no doubt that there's that's going to be an area there. But I do think, like, the way that Ireland team is set up, like, it's going to be reliant on, like, you know, energy covering ground. Like, everyone needs to be really in that system. If he's going to play with Aaron Connolly and, say, an O'Dowda-type player, you know, really pressed on a sort of a 4-3-3, then everyone has to work really hard behind. Like, it's going to be, like, you need to be 100% at it. And I'd give Doherty and Duffy probably another chance in the sense of where they're going to be, you know, with a month's more football under their belt. And in fact, you could say that with James McCarthy and a couple of other areas on the pitch as well. And I mean, I suppose the other thing about Duffy, the levels are fine. I guess at Celtic, they're going to dominate the ball and control games a lot of times. So it's not as if he needs to work on it. Like, he's been playing in the best league in the world. And as you said, like, he can do it. And I think sometimes it'd be simplistic to suggest that every player in that team is expected to be, you know, taking the ball out and stroke it, you know, sort of playing brilliant passes into midfield. If the team is working effectively enough, you know, he could give it to the fullbacks. There'd be options there for him. So there's more there to it. Like, I think Darrell Shea is interesting, but Johnny, Darrell Shea is more likely to be playing fullback at the start of the season for West Brom. The third centre half in the squad was Dara Lenihan initially, who, it's funny, like, we talk about Irish players in the Championship. Dara Lenihan's, what, 26 now, I think, but he's been around for a long time. And he's one, he was linked with Sheffield United last year. He's one whose profile is going to grow, I think, and could be one of these late-blooming Championship players, great attitude. And I thought it was significant he was included in the squad. He might be next in, but I think Duffy plays. I think, you know, let's see what he's like when he's actually playing football again regularly, because I think at least he'll be in a better position to judge him, I think.
Just, Gary, you played against Iceland. You were there with Mick when you were kind of finding your way in that, like, after 1996, and then eventually came good. You qualified for a World Cup. Is it the case that we should be really withholding judgment on Stephen Kenny until the World Cup qualification campaign is over, and we should just let him do what he needs to do in terms of the way he wants to play the game?
Well, listen, we knew that you're judged straight away. even if it's a work in progress, you want to see that that's identifiable, that you know what's happening. But if Stephen Kenny is a long-term appointment, then why is anyone judging him after two games, when effectively he's had so little time with them? And the big point, those players are not fit. That's the big difference. And people talk about, well, let's look and see how many of the lads play in the six games. It's not even about how many times you play. It's just the fact that you'll have 6 weeks more of training. That's the difference. This early on, you know, whether it be September, October, your pre-season fitness training, like, tied you over. Even if you're not playing in the first team, you'll be playing games, but it's the fitness training that you need more than anything else. So, listen, it will take time. I think initially the statements of Steve and Kenny, I'm going to revolutionise football, I'm going to change the way Ireland's perceived in world football, it was a bit too much, in my opinion, to begin with, because I think it puts unnecessary pressure on you, because my experience tells me that this was never going to be a quick fix. No chance. It wasn't. And it takes time for any new manager to bed in his philosophy. Now, these players will be better for it in terms of learning how he wants the team to play. The peace of mind that I get from this is that these players will be coached. That is all I wanted to see from an Ireland team. Just coach the players how you want them to play. Give them the pictures so that when they go on the pitch, they have an idea of where they're supposed to be, who's supposed to be around them, what are the passing patterns, and then judge the players then. Too often before under Martin O'Neill, in my opinion, and we heard the murmurings coming out of the camp, not enough work on the training ground, and teams picked at the last moment. You know, as great a manager as Martin O'Neill is at club level, that just didn't sit well with me.
I think in defence of him, Gary, there, in terms of the statements about revolutions and all that, he is all about kind of dictating a narrative, and the narrative is positive. And he would have come from a background where he thought that, Mick McCarthy and certainly previous managers just, like, even publicly didn't show enough faith in the players that they have. And that would be completely anathema to him. So he would play up players that, okay, like even players with Dundalk, you know, that were probably ostensibly out of their depth against the likes of Legia Warsaw, and, you know, in that 2016 run, he'd make them believe that by saying this in the press that they're well capable of going toe-to-toe. So whether he believes that himself is actually kind of a moot point, but it's kind of about dictating the narrative. But if you look at, as Gary said, I've never played at that level, so I'm just speculating, but I think not only do you have to make that breakthrough from, say, Championship to Premier League, or from, you know, under 19, under 18 to senior, there's then another break to make at an international level, because international football is different. And for me, I was absolutely gutted with myself. I backed Ireland to beat Finland on Sunday, and it was a stupid kind of heart over head bet in hindsight, because Finland are a team who've qualified for the Euros. They're together. They know what they're doing. They were really well set up. They were actually a good side, and I think they would have been competitive against virtually all teams in Europe to some extent. They would have played well. And Ireland had a tough challenge. And they had three midfielders who obviously had never played before together. Arthur was coming back. Malumbi was... This was a very, very tough baptism of fire. And then you have the two kids up front who are still just getting used to international football. So as much as Ireland were disappointed in both games, I think it'll take a long time. And I think they'll be a lot fitter. They'll be a lot sharper. And they'll be a lot more ready when the Slovakia game comes around. And I know you're saying he's put pressure on himself, Kenny, but I don't think he necessarily feels that pressure. I think he wants to inculcate in these players a belief that maybe he felt the other managers didn't have in them.
Okay, we got to.
Well, listen,
go on, Gary.
Sorry.
Go on quickly, Gary.
We'll come back to that after the break. But Mick McCarthy would have fooled their players with confidence. Look at Conor Horan, the difference he made. John Egan. Stevens, I just totally don't agree with Mick McCarthy not giving players confidence, because I've seen it. But in terms of the message, I know managers have that. This is their opportunity to talk to the supporters in terms of the messages that they give. But in terms of revolutionising and changing the perception of Irish players, you know what I mean? It was a bit too much to begin with.
Okay, we'll have the Liverpool Leeds team news very shortly after the break. 53106, any text messages? This is Off the Ball Saturday on News Talk. Back after this. You're welcome back to Off the Ball Saturday here on News Talk. John Duggan with you through till 5 o'clock in the company of the former Republic of Ireland defender Gary Breen, the Irish independent journalist Dan McDonald, and the broadcaster and journalist Johnny Ward, to talk about the beautiful game of football. Crystal Palace 1, Southampton 0, still in the Premier League. Earlier, Arsenal beat Fulham by 3-0. Tweet from Jack Ryan: will Shane Duffy be the highest scoring Irish player in the UK this season? Another text in here, 53106. Seamus Coleman is missed from the Irish team. The team lacks leadership. That is from a Sligo fan. We also got another text in here. Ignoring all the talk about the fitness of the Irish team is that all the other teams are in pre-season as well. We're looking at like.
The best player for Finland on the pitch the other day was Robert Taylor, who plays in Norway. He was 16 games into his season. So that's basically not correct.
Adam Ida has scored.
Yes, I just watched it there. Yeah, Adam Ida has come off the bench and scored for Norwich away to Huddersfield.
Isn't this because Stephen Kenny has given him so much confidence? All down to Kenny.
There you go, Jerry.
The big worry there is that he's not starting the games, and you're thinking, oh no, he needs to be playing. He comes on now with 15 minutes to go. I've just seen a substitution. And for his confidence to get a goal this early on in the season is brilliant. That's great news for us. It really is.
He badly needs games as well. Like he's physically probably not far off. He just needs games.
Look, Adam Ida's going to have a good career. But again, I really do think that what Stephen Kenny was doing in the last week, I do think he's been honest when he says that he was looking at his options. I think when it comes down to it for Slovakia, I don't think Ida's going to start. Well, injuries and all this, you can take that. But if everyone's fit, I don't think Ida's going to start. I'm saying it's not Ida, it's Ida. I don't think he's going to start. I don't think Malumbi's going to start. I think even Connolly's the borderline one. I think he wants to give him a chance. But I still wonder when push comes to shove, depending on how they view that game, might they still go for McLean? And I actually think the subs in the Finland game, that you ended up with McGoldrick and McLean and Callum Robinson, and wouldn't shock me if that was how things started. But I do think what Stephen wanted to do was to really look at them, to not have that sort of thing where, well, we haven't played them at international level before, as a means to not play them, as a reason for not playing them in a way, to give them a proper opportunity. And the one thing as well is that there's obviously a dual strand to this here, that Kenny will ultimately be judged, really, I think, as much as it's the biggest job in the country. So whatever happens in the Slovakia game, good or bad, there'll be an extreme reaction either way, because that's the gig, the job. That's just, if they lose, there'll be a reaction. And that's, I don't think people can be too sensitive to that either. Once it's sort of rational enough stuff and not sort of like end of days, have we made a terrible mistake stuff. But there is three games in October. And I think, there's going to be plenty of opportunities to further their career of, Ida and Connolly and these guys. Yeah. But I just sort of suspect for Slovakia that you might see it return back to a small bit more tried and trusted. I think the one player that he's desperate to play and I think will play would be James McCarthy if he plays regularly between now and
crucial.
Then.
He's crucial.
He's playing at the moment for Palace.
Given and the fact that he's able to patrol side to side, whoever the fullbacks are, both fullbacks, whoever's picked will be expected to get forward. You've got to have a midfielder who recognises that danger. Harry Arter was great in terms of hunting the ball. He'd done it a couple of occasions in that second game, done it really well. But you can't trust him to hold that holding midfield position because he just doesn't sense danger quick enough. As simple as that. His attributes are hunting the ball further forward and maybe losing himself in a bit of hard work. He doesn't have that positional discipline required.
I think the one problem he's going to have, John, sorry, is that there'll probably be a real desire to play Robbie Brady, but I'm not sure if Robbie Brady is going to play that much in the next month unless things change at Burnley. I think it's clear that he's someone that Stephen Kenny wants to use. He's someone he feels that in that central area can give them that maybe a small bit more creativity, but I'm not sure if he's necessarily going to get the game time.
That is not massively important at this stage. It's not in terms of, as long as he's doing the fitness work. Mm. At this early stage of the season, that's all really that matters.
You think, yeah. Okay. Yeah, no, I think he's got a chance to play. I really think, I wonder, does he want to reunite that Brady, Hendrick, McCarthy axis, which goes back to
we've all been waiting for since the Euros. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. I suspect, it wouldn't shock me if all things being equal, if that's what he went for, as much as I think Conor Hurren as well. And look, there's actually good options there. I mean, chances are we're going to lose someone through injury along the way or something, but there is at least options in midfield. But if he wants to keep playing that system that he does, that McCarthy role is really important. And he's the one that he needs to keep fit, in a quite substantial way.
Okay, got the teams from Liverpool and Leeds at Anfield. Shane Pennington.
Liverpool boss Jurgen Klopp names a strong starting lineup then for his side's first game in the Premier League this season. Both Trent Alexander-Arnold and Jordan Henderson start, as does Gini Wijnaldum. Salah, Mane and Firmino are all up top too. Whilst for Leeds, their big money signing Rodrigo starts on the bench, with Patrick Bamford leaving the line. Robin Koch does make his debut though in defence. At Anfield, it's Liverpool and Leeds.
We don't have that much time left. We got about, whatever, 8 or 9 minutes. I'm fascinated with Leeds this season, lads. Gary, the Bielsa project, he's enigmatic. It's going to be fascinating football. It's great to see them back in the Premier League. It's a pity they don't have their fans with them. But what's your prediction?
Well, listen, 16 years out of the Premier League is far too long for Leeds. It's great to have them back. It really is. And Bielsa is a manager who, if you're a student of football, as I am, in terms of like wanting to read as much as I can, all these top managers, Guardiola, Pochettino, they always reference him in terms of his teams. It's incredible, really, because he's not a serial winner by any stretch of the imagination. But in terms of how he's galvanised Leeds, he turns up, they're 14th in the table. He's done an incredible job. I'm fascinated. I really am, in terms of to see how they cope in the Premier League, because when I look at their stats, strong defensively, I think you're tested more in the Premier League than the Championship, of course. They like to play out from the back. You do that against Liverpool, you're in danger. You really are. But the big stat that really stood out for me is that they were bottom of the table in the Championship for the chances converted. Now, if you're a promoted team, if you don't take the fewer chances you're going to hit in the Premier League, you are seriously in trouble. So that is something they have to address to survive.
That is fascinating stuff. Guys, I just really hope it works for them. I would be disappointed to see Leeds in their relegation scrap.
Yeah, I mean, the relegation picture is actually pretty hard to really, you know, to come down firm, I think, in any view. Like, even with the likes of sort of Fulham and West Brom coming up, you'd expect that they, along with Leeds, you'd expect they'll be signing players in the next couple of weeks that might change your view of them. But I mean, it's possible. Like, you sort of assume that Aston Villa come back up, you know, huge club, and that they would, you know, they would take off. But I mean, they just couldn't. And I wasn't aware of that stat now about the chances converted. It's sort of
like, yeah.
Leeds have been very entertaining the last couple of seasons. They've been involved in some absolutely crazy games in the Championship, like, you know, the late goals in games, the drama, the emotion. Like, they've been a sort of thrilling side who, at times, like, there was that season where they looked absolutely gassed. You know, they were completely run out of steam. I think what Gary said earlier about the lockdown helping them is probably true. There's been other times, though, where they've had these late rallies in games and, you know, they've finished unbelievably strongly. Now, again, to a degree, I think in the early part of the season, that was probably influenced by the home crowd and the energy that they're not necessarily going to draw on initially. And, like, Bielsa's history is it does, there is that slight niggling feeling, like, could this really swing in two ways here dramatically? You know, if things don't start well, you know, could it go in another way completely? But I don't think that's going to happen. I think there's actually enough, for all I say, the relegation picture is quite clear. I think there's enough sort of average enough teams down there that have their problems that leads the momentum. They should be able to steer clear of it. You're looking at even West Ham, things don't seem to be 100% great there. I like Brighton, but
they never are at West Ham, are they?
No, that's true. Maybe it's just the default position at West Ham. You know it. It's like it's.
Oh, yeah, I know it. Yeah.
But even the Mark Noble stuff, like, you know, openly talking about the sale of the Grady Diang to West Brom, and Declan Rice agreeing with him or liking a tweet or something. You just don't like to see that, you know. And even Aston Villa's one for me as well, that, you know, if they weren't great last year, really, you know. And, no. And they need...
United are going to implode, Dan, aren't they?
Oh, I don't know about it. I don't know about implode.
They're going to have a much weaker season.
But the second season syndrome thing is going to be a challenge.
That Villa, second album. Watkins,
you know, like, you know, Ollie Watkins from Brentford, 28 million. Like, it's grand, but, like, so there's enough there that you would think Leeds, if they've signed well, and Rodrigo obviously is the high profile one, that they'll be okay. But they still might miss the manic energy of that crowd as well, and they're missing from it. But they should be okay.
Lads, we could talk for another hour, but unfortunately we got to go. Speak next week. Thanks
guys.
Cheers, champ.
It's Gary Breen, Dan McDonald there and Johnny Ward on Off the Ball Saturday here. Just letting you know, Palace 1-0 up against Southampton into injury time in the Premier League. Don't forget Off the Ball Sunday tomorrow from 1. Richie McCormack in the chair will bring you live and exclusive commentary of two Premier League matches. Stephen Doyle and Kenny Cunningham will be in the commentary box. For West Bromwich Albion and Leicester City, that kicks off at 2. Then Nathan Murphy and Brian Kerr will call the shots for the half-four kickoff between Tottenham Hotspur and Everton. As always, we'll also bring you the pay-per-view on our digital channels. So if you missed our Saturday panel, looking ahead to the Pro 14 final, just remember there's another one next week at 1:30. And of course, you can listen as well to the podcast of our football chat with Gary Breen, Dan McDonald and Johnny Ward as we preview the Premier League season. I hope you enjoy today's football and tomorrow's football as well. Search OTB Sports in your app store to download our app for iOS and Android, or check out the content wherever you get your pods. Thanks so much for listening this afternoon. We'll speak soon. Bye-bye.
Football on Off the Ball
with Paddy Power, fueling the mischief in the beautiful game. Gamble responsibly. CWE.net.
That was an OTB Podcast Network presentation.